Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we're asking Valerius Geist why Homo sapiens evolved into artists. This episode was made possible by a generous donation from David Bjerkley of Montclair, New Jersey. We thank him for his support and hope that he will inspire others to do the same. You can donate securely at whyradioshow.org. There is a debate that is consuming universities across the country. Administrators are now only interested in cultivating the so-called practical subjects. At my own University of North Dakota, they want to give money to the schools of business and aviation and invest in rural medicine and energy production. They're mostly uninterested in music, English, philosophy, and the arts. They even have little time for pure science. Physics or biology for its own sake is deemed worthless because it does not guarantee a financial return on the investment. For the UND administration, even the STEM subjects are only worthwhile when they concern themselves with areas like information technology or unmanned aircraft systems, down-to-earth, marketable, fashionable practicalities that they think makes UND more attractive to granting agencies and parents. This, I must say, is a very odd orientation to have. What they mean by practical makes 99% of even their own experience invisible. Pretty much every administrator redecorates his or her office during the first weeks of the job. They all hang art on the walls and want nice desks. They wear formal business clothes, groom themselves, and have fashionable and appropriate hairstyles. More money is spent on the way administrators want to look than on copier paper or parking passes. Art is, whether they acknowledge it or not, more than just practical. It is a human necessity. Today, we will ask why this is. What does art provide that humanity cannot get from something else? To find an answer, we will turn to evolution. Neanderthals did not have art, neither did Homo erectus. Art developed alongside our ability to herd livestock and grow crops. This means that it must have a purpose. Nothing useless evolves. Or to put it another way, art appears to be a necessary component of the survival of the fittest. I'm not going to anticipate what purpose art serves. I'll leave that to my guest. But I would like to suggest that to understand art evolutionarily is to see it in terms of the skills it requires and cultivates: creativity, imagination, communication, collaboration, mutual understanding, not to mention color differentiation, object manipulation, dexterity, categorization and classification, scent identification, even aural reproduction. Studies of contemporary schoolchildren show time and time again that students who learn art do better in math and writing. It teaches them problem-solving and critical thinking. It inspires everyone to think differently, to see the perspectives of others better, and to improve our own self-awareness. Surely these skills were just as important for early humans as they are for those of us who live in the 21st century. It's easy to think of evolution as somehow separate from our day-to-day lives. We live in cities and towns. Early humans were at home on the African plains. We think of ourselves as individuals, but only describe our ancestors' tribes. When we hunt, we do it for sport or tradition, but there is little there to recall the scarcity and desperation that early hunters faced. It takes more imagination to see our continuity with the creatures who came before us than it does to see what we have in common with those who live on the other side of the world, perhaps in cultures that we don't understand, with practices that might even horrify us. But there is nothing more natural than the connection between early human beings and the people whom we call our friends and family. Scientists can show with precision and detail all the steps between them and us, the progressive developments that got us from there to here. They can also show, as we shall see, that we could not have developed scientific practices if we had not learned how to be artists, and we could not have become entrepreneurial if we were neither imaginative nor creative. There is no clear and distinct difference between art, science, business, engineering, and other human endeavors. You can't have one without the other. What some university administrators refuse to see is that the holistic nature of the human experience is key. UND leadership is blind to the fact that their scheme to be the most influential university in the world when it comes to drones will necessarily fall short if there is no meaningful attention to the arts. Without lessons in creativity, neither students nor professors will be capable of innovation. This has been true since the moment that our species could be identified as human. In fact, what I suspect today's episode will show is that if we didn't have art, we couldn't be called human at all. And now our guest. Valerius Geist is Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science, Faculty of Environmental Design at the University of Calgary. He's the author of more than a dozen books, a specialist on the biology, behavior, and social dynamics of North American large mammals. He's also a champion of ethical hunting and a wildlife artist. Val, welcome to Why Radio.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
We've pre-recorded this episode, so we won't be taking emails. But if you'd like to comment, please email us at whyradioshow@und.edu, tweet us at whyradioshow, or post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/whyradioshow. You can always visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Val, evolution is one of those things that, you know, I sort of know a little bit about, and I know enough to nod my head when other people are talking and sort of know when someone is completely off. But I don't really know much more than that. So I first titled the show Why Humans Evolved into Artists. But in our initial email exchange, you actually asked me to change that to Why Homo Sapiens Evolved into Artists. Why is this difference so important? Isn't it all just one line of progress?
Well, that is the conventional wisdom, but that is not quite true. Human beings, very, very different from us, evolved. In fact, the main line of human beings died out. We are a side branch of that line. And if you allow me a little bit, I will go into the ancient history.
Sure.
We became humans. Yes, we became humans in the best sense of humans about 2 million years ago. Subsequently to that, we had a very, very long, slow period of evolution. Really, it was more or less much of the same with the refinements. That is the Homo erectus stage. That is our parent species, which was an enormously successful species. It arose, as I said, about 2 million years ago, 1.8 million years ago, sometimes thereabouts, and almost instantaneously spread to Europe. It spread to Asia, deep, deep into Asia. And it remained alive in Africa for about 1.5 million years. And it remained alive in China, Central Asia, another 500,000 years. They, in fact, the last remnants of that species may have died out as late as the beginning of agriculture, 11,000 years ago in China. So it was a very successful group of populations, let's call it, of our parent species. Another side branch of that was Neanderthal. Now, the main line of human evolution went from Africa into Europe as a robust Homo erectus, and they lived a very good life there. Europe is rich. Africa is very poor in many regards, but Europe was a very rich landscape to live off on. And that is where eventually Neanderthal evolved. And they were a sister species of us, but very different from us, very, very different from us. What happened simultaneously as Neanderthal evolved in Europe, simultaneously a side branch in the deserts of Africa began to evolve. And the beginning of that goes back about 600,000 years when a major change in glaciation patterns occurred. We are living today in the ice ages. The ice ages are about 2.5 million years long. And up to about 600,000 years ago, the cycle of glaciation and interglacials lasted about 41,000 years. At about 600,000 years ago, there was a major switch. And the cycles extended itself to 100,000 years and became much more cold and hot at the same time. And that is the very, very beginning of this group of hard-struggling, initially Homo erectus, adapting to dry landscapes. Because what happens during the glaciation is that Africa desiccates because so much of the water of the globe is withdrawn into huge glaciers in the South and North Pole and, of course, on the continents. And so the beginning of us was a struggle to adapt to dry landscape, to deserts. And we differentiated in the process tremendously.
So let me, if you don't mind me interrupting for just a second, I'm interested as a philosopher is this distinction of what makes a species, right?
Yes.
You're talking about three different types, but there is clearly in some sense a gradation of difference.
Yes.
So quantity or when does the quantity of difference become a qualitative difference? So what makes a species discrete from another species? How do we separate them?
We separate them by virtue of how they have adapted to make a living. And to give you an idea, when Homo erectus came into Europe, they found a rich landscape. They became large, and they themselves were already extremely good hunters. They now focused on the largest of mammals, and they did fairly well. And then came along these very massive glaciations. And during these massive glaciations, they learned to kill elephants and large mammals without restraining them. Now, this is an important point here in the sense that Homo erectus was able to dig slit trenches by which the mammoth and early elephants fell in and had their front legs bound. Under those circumstances, they could use a pointed stick, basically, to puncture the sides of the animal and allow air to enter the lung cavity and suffocate them to death. Neanderthal deviated from that by being able to kill unrestrained mammoth, unrestrained rhinos, unrestrained bison on snow and ice and on frozen surfaces. And in order to do that, there was a tremendous change in body form, in mentality, in almost everything. So although they were humans and are human beings, they were very different human beings from us. The way that Neanderthal killed was to attract a mammoth. Two hunters would attract. One would try and jump and grab onto the fur at the side of the animal. The animal would start spinning around about trying to shake that hunter. And the other hunter killed it with a very massive spear. It was very dangerous, and broken bones were the norm for Neanderthal. The ability to make a livelihood was slim, because even ladies participated and broke bones in the process of hunting. And the large brain that they had, which was even larger than ours at times, was in the service of vision. The areas of the brain that are large are enlarged because they had to use night vision, basically, and night vision is necessary for an apex predator. And that is exactly what Neanderthal was. So meeting a Neanderthal for you and I would have been a nightmare. They were very, very different human beings. If you took a little baby Neanderthal, yes, you could raise it with us. Yes, it would learn language. But it would be a very difficult human being to live with. They would be quite violent. They were enormously strong. And I suspect they were not very philosophical.
Well, and I'm glad you bring up the word philosophical, because as you're talking, I'm thinking of course, many different questions. And there was a question I was going to ask later on in the show, but I guess I want to ask now, in part because it's a leading question, and in part because it's going to make some of our listeners angry. We think of evolution as progressive, as the things that are later are better. And you're describing Neanderthals and Homo sapiens as creatures who are defined at least in part how they kill their food, how they create their sustenance.
Very much so.
Yet we have a large ethical movement of human beings who want to be vegetarians and vegans.
Yes, that's correct.
Who are not interested in killing. Is that, for lack of a better term, devolution? And the question that I'm actually asking here is not, are vegans bad, but rather, can we get moral claims and notions of progress that are applicable to today's world from the evolutionary patterns of human beings?
Well, I don't see it that way. I don't see any progress. In fact, I understand that this is a concept of the Middle Ages that in the 15th, 16th century arose, where they thought that they were the ancients. Looking back at the great achievements of the Romans, the Greek, and the Egyptians. And when the exploration began, they suddenly realized, not suddenly, they realized that, yes, there was a future, and that because of the continuous discoveries and so on, that there was progression, and there the notion arose that tomorrow is going to be a better day than today, there is progress. But this is not really true in evolution. Evolution is adapts the creature to the circumstances of its environment. And it's good that you cut into the business of vegetarian veganism, because we are a very peculiar creature indeed. Although our pattern of evolution, oddly enough, mimics that of large herbivores as we progressed from the tropics through the temperate zones into the periglacial zones, into the Arctic, the mountain, and so on and so forth. That pattern is very similar to that of goat and sheep and deer and elephants and rhinos and so on and so forth. But physiologically, we are actually a carnivore. We have systems of enzymes that are strictly there to digest animal food. We're an oxymoron. We are a meat-eating herbivore. But progress is not something that you will discover in evolution, only in the sense that, yes, animals become better adapted with time. Just like Neanderthal was much more generalized about 100,000 or 130,000 years ago. And during the last glaciation, the Worm glaciation, it became the body form and became much more extreme, so that the extreme environment, extreme Neanderthals, were the ones that met us about 40,000 years ago in Europe and eventually succumbed.
So another, I guess, extreme philosophical question. When I was reading, you were very kind enough to share me an early version of a chapter of a book that you're writing, and it was incredibly fascinating. And for someone like myself, for whom a lot of this information is new, I couldn't help notice that every explanation of change in evolution was inspired by or reacting to climate or geography.
Yes.
And the question, and it may sound a little strange, hopefully you and the listeners know what I mean. Does it make sense to differentiate between the evolving creature and the climate and the geography? Are they so connected and so dependent on one another that really a creature is just another aspect of a geography or a climate? Or are they just – am I just – overthinking it, a phrase I don't like to use on this show, but am I just overthinking it because we're just reactive creatures? The evolution seems so tied into the context and the place and the that,
yes,
that the creatures found, that I find it hard to distinguish between the two. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. You're quite right. We are, in the first instance, during evolution, we're very, very closely tied to landscape, to climate, to the biota that is around and about us. Now, mind you, once we have, in the case of our own species, once we have reached a level of affluence, we can be free to do things that are way outside nature, of course.
And affluence means a lot of food and,
yes,
and security.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right?
Yes. May I give you an example? It's a bit how shall I call it? It's a bit – I'm thinking right now of the German term, beklemmend. It's a little bit uncomfortable. But in the Western Eurasia, at 40,000 years, a group of people came out of Africa. And they developed a technology that was far superior for exploiting the landscape than Neanderthal had. And they grew in abundance, but above all, they grew in body size and in health and in culture. Because when you are wealthy, A number of things happen. First of all, there's a biological change. I'll go into that a little bit later. But there is also a cultural response. It's when we are affluent that we can indulge in culture. And this is the culture of the cave painters. And they became totally infatuated with reproducing things on stone and on bone and so on and so forth. And the basic philosophy was, if you could sketch it, you could have it. So if you would sketch a reindeer, the anticipation was that you could get that reindeer. There were other things also they were sketching, some pornographic, so I don't have to go into that. so you get the idea. And they developed a culture of eulogy towards their ancestors. And they believed that their ancestors were living down deep in the caves, and that's where they went and brought them gifts. And the gifts that they brought were images of their lives. And they also left behind knives and, we think, some food as well. And they left behind their identity in the form of handprints and so on and so forth. They had a very, very lively imagination about what was going on. Now, that is something of a luxury. And our ability for you and I to freely talk about all these things are also a function of luxury. In other words, luxury frees us from the narrow constraints that otherwise would exist.
And by luxury, you mean very, very basic luxury. We are not running from animals at the moment.
Correct.
We can be in a specific location for a period of time. We're not constantly looking for food. We can have moments or longer periods of
Absolutely.
Rest.
Absolutely. That's right. This is the tremendous beauty of the Homo sapiens, that we have been able to build these magnificent cultures. Well, they were very destructive, of course, at the same time. But basically, we civilized the continent. And that was only possible when we had a surplus of food to build on. And then our imagination began to do the rest, because we're living, of course, very much a life of imagination, etc. But I would like to make one more thing clear. When you have luxury conditions, it is not simply that you are free to do various interesting things, but you change biologically. A person that is raised under luxury food conditions and luxury environment, that means very good care, parental care, and so on and so forth, is in many regards a different person than one that is raised under great poverty conditions. And I think one of some of the most startling examples that I found in that was the description by French surgeons, French medical men that had been banished from Paris because of their views, and they were sent into the countryside, and they were describing the extreme poverty that was to be found in the French villages at that in pre-revolutionary France. And these individuals working or trying to do something about the health and so on realized how impossible it was, because these people were so mentally constrained, so they could not accept novelty. We have actually that in biology. What happens is the following. When you have luxury, it normally means that the animal is dispersing into a new environment.
Actually, Val, let me interrupt you for just a second, because we do need to take a break. And also, you are starting to pull the thread that is going to be the core of the next discussion. and I think it's incredibly interesting. We will come back. We'll talk about novelty. We'll talk about innovation. We'll talk about creativity and imagination. And we'll talk about this notion of art as a luxury and how that may translate into misunderstanding what exactly evolutionary luxury is. But before that moment, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Valerius Geist and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and we'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Valerius Geist and asking why Homo sapiens evolved into artists. And an unfortunate thing happened to me this morning, and this is going to seem apropos of the discussion, but in fact, it is true. I went to sleep late last night. I was preparing for the show. And then early this morning, around 5 o'clock, I wake up and I hear this noise, and it's a little odd, and I'm trying to picture it. And suddenly I realize what it is, and I run into my bathroom, and our bathroom is flooding. There's water all over the floor. Ooh. It is sinking down into our living room beneath, and our couch is acting as a sponge.
Oh my.
And then it is cascading into our basement. So I spent the 3 hours that I should have been sleeping and doing some more preparation, cleaning, turning pipes off, turning the breakers off, all of this sort of stuff, bringing carpets and rugs into the backyard. My wife goes next door to our neighbors, who are very wonderful people and who are North Dakota natives. And she tells them what happens and just keep an eye on the house in case there's an electrical fire or something. And they express sadness and empathy for us. And she says, well, it could have been worse. We could have been away on vacation for 4 days. And Delaine, our neighbor, got super excited and she said, finally, you are a North Dakotan. The moment you say it could have been worse, you have become of our culture. That is the North Dakota way. Whatever happens, it could be worse. And I bring that up because this really shows this distinction of luxury that you are talking about. When we are cleaning the water, when we are running to turn the pipes off, when we are trying to preserve the house, there's no luxury and we're not thinking about it could be worse. We're just thinking, oh my God, I have to fix this. But the moment it calms down and we know that we have a home and we know that we have some insurance and we know that we have a fire department and we know that we have people looking, then we can have this more philosophical perspective. And so I guess I tell this story in part because I'm thinking about it, but in part because it brings this notion of the evolutionary ability to think that things could be otherwise, right. This notion of novelty, that we can imagine things worse, but we can also make things better. And so I guess I want to ask you, at what point do human beings develop this ability to innovate, to think about novelty, and to develop imagination, creativity, which we'll talk about in more detail in a bit, to think that things could be other than they are or that they can make things better than they are?
What you're describing so beautifully, really, really beautifully, is the ability that we evolved in desert situations. We are a desert adapted species, and the ability that you that you showed in the time of crisis is something that evolved over about 600,000 years in desert situation, because the desert is a very capricious environment, and we had to counter this capriciousness of the environment by a tremendous investment in intellect, but above all a tremendous investment in language and a tremendous investment in our way in culture, so that we were able to benefit from each other's insights and also from each other's experiences, as well as being able to go to neighbors in case things were very, very bad and live with them. We could not do what our parent species was doing previously, which was living in territories along water edges and defending these. That was Homo erectus. But ours was an immense break away from that. And that is where that large prefrontal cortex that we have comes into our own. It was so crucial in desert conditions to be precise in giving information, because you would have to tell somebody where a waterhole was that was miles away. And if you missed that waterhole, you might not survive. you had to be able to judge correctly that you went to a group of people that had a surplus of resources when yours began to falter. In other words, under the desert conditions, under the trying conditions of the desert, which, by the way, Homo erectus did not survive, but we did. And we were, as said, a side branch. And this is where the glory of the Homo sapiens begins, and that is what brought us to the future.
What happens evolutionary that allows Homo sapiens to say something like, well, we live in a desert, but with some tools and technology, we can bring water to us. We live in forest with some effort. We can, we can make Israel into a place where you can grow oranges.
Correct.
Right. What happens evolutionary there?
Well, what happens evolutionary? You start with little steps. You're talking about big steps, but the little steps would be in under desert conditions, making day-to-day decisions on which life depends. And these would be decisions based on the collective wisdom and understanding of those around you, of those that live maybe 200 kilometers away somewhere, which you will want to visit. And it is here where those survived, basically, that were able to shed previously any notion of territoriality and were able to open themselves up to other individuals and listen to them, incorporate what they have to say, and then go through in the consequent fashion with their action. And these are important points because desert conditions are, because of the marginality and so on, will put strains on you. You may have to wander several days before you succeed in doing what you want to do. And this is also where individuals succeeded that had a very labile brain, that were able to generate novelty, because novelty is exactly what our parent species and our sister species, Neanderthal, were very hard at getting at. We were eventually not, but it took, well, 500,000 years in order to get there. They were very, very, very special, but that special ability was generated on the basis of living under very, very harsh conditions in African deserts.
One of the hardest things I find personally in talking about evolution is this contrast between massive amounts of time and tiny little steps and capabilities.
Yes.
That you're talking about hundreds of thousands of years,
right,
and yet you're also talking about the ability to use a tool for the first time or discover the difference between, I don't know, digging and something a little more than digging. Years ago, I took a helicopter ride over the Grand Canyon. And
if you look
at the Grand Canyon from the side, which is what most people do, it's completely inconceivable. When you fly over the Grand Canyon, this is the word I've always used to describe it, it's granular. It all looks like sand. And it's the only time I ever had a sense of how over a huge period of time, the Colorado River could in fact dig out this canyon little bit.
Your imagination went wild. I'm quite sure about that.
It did, and it has stuck with me much longer than the relationship that I was trying to save by buying a helicopter trip.
But I wanted to get at something at this ability to innovate. Yeah, the ability to innovate is what art is all about. In other words,
excellent,
art is a proxy
excellent
for innovation, the ability to conceive something new. I'll give you a little tiny example, which is so typical of the human mind. I was listening recently to a talk by an emergency room doctor from Ethiopia, and he was practicing out of a hospital that was called the Black Lion. Now, nothing particularly grand about this, is there?
Not that
but
I can
it's
think
very,
of.
Very typical human. You see, there are no such things as black lions. So black and lion, two totally unrelated things are being put together, and we swoop, accept that instantly as something meaningful, in fact. And this is exactly what we do. We take things, we can abstract them, and we can generate a reality all of its own in that. Yeah, that's why we love novels so much. That's why we love stories so much. None of them are true in an absolute sense, but they give us a wonderful sense of direction, of adventure, of living outside. And this is based on this ability to take bits and pieces of unrelated reality and put them together. And that's the basis of art.
Novels give us novelty, right?
Maybe.
But I want to stop just for a second because you're saying something incredibly important. And the philosophers in the audience and folks who have read Descartes will remember that in the beginning of his meditations, in one of the early steps,
cogito ergo sum.
Yeah, he thinks about, well, people can take pumpkins and substitute them for heads.
Yes.
And this is why we don't necessarily know that we're talking about human beings. But he describes this as a very basic, easy skill that human beings have. And what you're describing is that this is an incredibly difficult and complex skill that is won over massive periods of time.
Yes, correct. Your wonderful plasticity of mind and of brain is exactly what you got over this enormous period of time. Yes, you're right. And as I wanted to point out, there is sort of a flexibility within that. And the flexibility is maximized by living under luxury conditions, having luxury food. It is minimized when you get yourselves into conditions of severe hardship in which the children grow up. And they are biologically different under those circumstances. Tragically, tragically, tragically. But that is something that we have to understand. In other words, we are fully capable of being human, of being artistic, of being generous, of being socially, if we are living under conditions that are basically at the luxury end. And we're very fortunate that we happen to be living under these conditions currently in this continent.
This is a tangent that we don't have to follow, but is this why there's so little art during wartime? Is this why right now Syria is not going to produce great pieces of literature or visual beauty because everyone is just hunkered down and desperately trying to get through every minute?
Well, what you're speaking about is survival mode, yeah? When you generate poverty, you put people into survival mode. There will be still art there, but it will be produced with greater difficulties. It will be secondary, yeah? Whereas the vivaciousness comes about with living under luxury conditions. And, this is where we reach the peak of our humanity.
So if we're following this step, we've reached a period of luxury and mm-hmm. we're looking for novelty. Then there's this other capacity for creativity, this human ability. What's the difference between – where does creativity fit in and how does creativity develop evolutionarily that lets us reach into novelty, that lets us adjust and change the world and think about how we want those changes to be?
Well, creativity is novelty. That's what by definition creativity is, yeah? And as I said, we were brought to that step by step by step through a horrendously torturous process over 500,000 years because the environment that we were surviving in, and that was the only environment human beings could survive in at that time point, during these massive glaciations in the north and desiccations in the south, yeah, was to face the desert squarely and learn and innovate and transmit knowledge and move around and about and develop that flexibility that is so typical of our species. You see, we have lived in a very, very different world than, as we began talking about, our brother, our sister species, Neanderthal, which lived under luxury conditions in Europe, developed in a totally different fashion.
I want to push this because I want to see if I can frame the question that I was getting at in distinguishing in my mind between novelty and creativity. And part of what I think I'm asking is when we talk about novelty, we talk about change and this ability to create something new. But creativity, as I'm thinking about it, is an even more drastic imaginative process. Mm-hmm. It's being able to think through the consequences of things over long periods of time, to have a vision of the house completed in your head.
That's right.
And so
yes, correct.
How long does it take – if I don't know if this is answerable, but how long does it take to get from the immediate steps of I can change this one thing to going to much more larger cognitive tasks and generalizations and step by step by step by step? I remember years ago there was a very popular book called Clan of the Cave Bear, and I'm sure it was completely inaccurate. But there was a scene where the proto-human and the human are – they're raising this probably Homo sapien woman by Homo erectus probably and he's talking about – the chief is trying to teach her how to count. And he says, you know, count your fingers 1 through 10 and then you can pick another finger 11. And mm-hmm. she says, oh, right. And then you can do 10 more and you get 20 and 10 more and then you get 30. And the chief couldn't figure it out. He could only get to like 13 in his head. How long did it take to make that jump from very small immediate changes to – the ability to really play out long strains of causation and change and ideas fully in the imagination?
Well, again, if we step back into the picture of evolution that I've described, what you are doing when you are in this wonderful state of free-floating imagination and so on, you are taking advantage of the total complexity, of the total ability of the brain. And as I said, it comes out during times when you can be playful, when you can be relaxed, when you have a good time. And that is when you have the leisure to sit back and go through it all. But the basis of that were bits and pieces of adaptations that we accumulated over about 500,000 years, most strongly about 200,000 years ago. There might be even be an interesting sideline, because we came out of Africa about 270,000 years ago without success. We met Neanderthal. There was some interbreeding. Neanderthal carried some mitochondrial DNA from human beings, which means there some women were raped. And that thrust died out. It was the next thrust that came out and eventually triumphed over Neanderthal man. And when you look at the scarce fossil material, you can see the buildup in the skull structure towards the one that we carry today. So, yes, it was gradual, bits by bits by bits by bits. But these bits added together, and they can be drawn out and utilized in a wonderful fashion, provided we have the luxury to sit back and relax and imagine and do things in a joyous fashion.
So you brought up play, and this is the first time that we've encountered this in this discussion, this notion that we can be joyful. Perhaps there's humor at this point.
Oh, yes, of course.
You know, and so does art, as we understand it, develop simultaneously with play, simultaneously with humor, or is play a precondition for art, or is art a precondition for play? What's the relationship? Because I want to move us towards now figuring out exactly what the purpose of art is. But what's the relationship? Is all of this happening at the same time, or is it an ordered process?
Well, but of play itself is an ordered process. Play is nothing random. You play with things in a fashion that is, and suddenly out of this process of play, something clicks, and you eureka effect sets in. Yeah, and art is play. And it's a wonderful kind of play, yeah? But it is a little bit removed from reality at times, which as a member of the Faculty of Environmental Design I noticed, because I saw that art trumped reason, and I understood why architects needed half a dozen engineers to make sure that their creations stood right. and didn't collapse, you see? Art is play.
So if art is play, then there are people who are going to, at this point, interpret us as saying art is unnecessary.
So then
what does art and what does play provide that is so essential to both the human experience and to the evolutionary process?
Well, let me put it this way. First of all, to your last statement, the evolutionary process. There is very little evolution currently going on. And there's very little evolution going on because we are so very well buffered by a very, very extensive cultural system of looking after ourselves, of looking after our well-being, that as far as evolution is concerned, we're stagnant at the present time. But that's fine. I've got no problems at all with that. the necessity of for art is that it this wonderful play with everything around us, yeah, is in itself exciting. I mean, the Eureka moment is, I live for it, for God's sake. That's why I'm a scientist. Yeah. And yes, when I sit down on my computer, there is, in a sense, a play going on till an hour or so down the road. Whoops, I have seen a new insight that no human being has ever seen before, you see. And that capacity allows us to deal with very, very difficult problems, because it is a bouncing back and forth between play and disciplined thinking that we advance. That's how the atomic bomb was developed, for heaven's sake. That's how any new design is developed. This is why teams of people come together. It is stimulating the imagination, playing around about till something clicks, something makes sense. And here is the solution to the problem that we've had, okay?
Mm-hmm. So in your writing, you talked about a stage of art that was connected to population density and the size of kin groups.
Yes.
Art. Would you talk a little bit about this, about the way that art was used to help identify them and us and who's part of the group and the role?
Of course.
Talk a little bit about that aspect of it, because I find that fascinating.
Well, what I'm going to talk about is a little bit outside at first, but let me put it this way. We behave amongst one another in a typical mammalian biological fashion, like all vertebrates do. That is, we generate status, and we label that status. And we have the easiest way to look at it is look at the military. The status is labeled. You can see at a glance what status there is as such. Yeah? And individuals, in fact, are driven to maximize status, to go up in status.
What's the evolutionary reason for that?
Well, the evolutionary reason is very simple. The higher up in status you are at the primitive level, the better you eat.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. And that's, by the way, gives you a little idea. When you tame a wolf, wolves are beautiful creatures, particularly, and they are beguiling creatures when they're young. And they will generate in you all sorts of love and attention, God knows what else. The moment the hormones change, the wolf switches into another mode now. That's the adult mode. And the adult mode tries to better its status. And eventually, that beautiful, tame, beloved little wolf is going to attack you. And that's a guarantee. And if you beat him down, for the rest of his life, he'll remain subordinate to you. But the point is this. Why is he doing it? He's doing this to gain status, because if you go up in status, you eat better.
Hmm.
It's that brutal.
And for our listeners, you wrote a book on wolves and wolf culture and interaction, and you've spent a significant amount of time in your career working on this, and I know that material is fascinating. I'll have a link on the website to your book on that. So art and the connection between status and the population density.
Well,
and things like that.
Look at Hermann Göring as an example. This gets us a little back into our age. He was an individual that used art, body art, yeah, to decorate himself more and more and more. He stood out completely, and everywhere he stood out completely, because he was covered with all sorts of junk that indicated that he was a very high status individual, you see. And this is a very primitive use of art, but it's there. And we decorate ourselves to make ourselves distinct and somehow individualistic, that we are recognized. And that's part of our biology. But, of course, you see, art is in the novel. Art is in dance. Art is in music. Art is in entertainment, whenever we are together and so on. This is the gift, basically, that evolution gave us from surviving these very, very hard times under very trying conditions over hundreds of thousands of years in Africa.
I want to take a step back.
Sure.
I want to ask a different question that I'm sure will lead us to this point. We've talked about the time period, and you actually, one of the very first things you said in our discussion was that the common notion is that there's a line of progress, but you disagree with that, and you explain why, and I'm of course convinced. But what are, and when we think about evolution, those lay people, we think about, well, people disagree about facts and how what happens here, what happens there. But what are the philosophical debates that divide evolutionary theorists? What kind of foundational, theoretical, even paradigmatic controversies are there that will help us understand a little bit more about what it means to do a philosophy of evolution and the way that philosophy itself is interwoven in the scientific process?
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry about that.
Well, no. The point is that scholars working amongst each other have disagreements, which is the way it should be. And if we are collegial about it, we work through it, and we have processes of testing and so on and so forth that gives us... But there is, first of all, no disagreement among students of evolution that it takes place.
Right.
The only disagreements are how does it take place, and under what circumstances does it take place, and what happens here or there, and so on and so forth. So when I write a paper, I'm going to be criticized very likely by somebody who has seen something different, and I'm very, very happy to see that he can point out a mistake of mine. And if he does, I have learned something, and I'm a step further ahead. We, as evolutionists, we live in a culture in which honesty, integrity, and sticking to facts and sticking to reason are absolutely primary, absolutely primary. And we are having a wonderful time when we meet. We can discuss various other things and so on and so forth. But there is basically no great debate about the existence of evolution. It is there. Where the interesting part arises is what we are discussing. How did we come to this state? How is it possible that we can ask questions about the universe? Well, when you were sitting in African deserts, universe, you're looking out at the universe. You're seeing the stars and the moon, and you can see comets going by. And that is where we developed an interest in astronomy, which, by the way, helped us defeat Neanderthal, you see. Because when we came into Western Europe, we developed a way of hunting reindeer that was totally unique. We intercepted the migratory herds by virtue of a calendar. The ability to have to count time, which is a tremendous invention, yeah? It was the moon cycle calendar that they had, apparently. But you need to have a calendar in order to predict correctly the time of migration. If you don't have a calendar, you cannot predict anything. But there is the link between sitting in the desert, looking out at the sky, seeing the movement of heavenly bodies, developing stories about them, because we see the constellations, we've labeled the constellations, yeah? And human beings are incredibly keen eyed about little movements in the sky when they are observers of the night sky. And that observation then brought us to the stage where we applied it. And we applied it to intercepting reindeer, killing them in excess, preserving the meat and the skins, etc., etc. And we grew in stature, in beauty, in size, in population size, and we starved out Neanderthal man. And it all began by watching the skies and having an imagination about what these little dots could do. Okay?
Does every human... when I wrote this note to myself, I had behavior, capacity, ability. I couldn't find the word. But does every human behavior have an evolutionary explanation? Is there anything that we do that... doesn't have a precedent, but that doesn't fit the model of explanation that we're using today?
Well, by virtue of being able to imagine, by virtue of able to put these bits and pieces of imaginary entities together, we are, of course, dealing with things that have never been seen, that have never been experienced, and so on and so forth, which takes us away from the here and now of any relationship to our past, basically. The mind that we evolved allowed us this wonderful liberation so that you and I can discuss these sort of things in an abstract. Yes, the capacity to do that links back to our evolutionary past. But what we are imagining has no relationship. Think of the wonderful dances that the choreographer can develop, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
They're totally new. They've never been seen before. There they are, yeah? We enjoy them greatly. And we are always on the lookout for novelty. And that's part and parcel of the ancient past. If we looked out for novelty, we learned something. And if we learned something, it helped us survive.
Is the fundamental way an evolutionist seeks answers, is it Aristotelian in the sense, is it teleological in the sense that you ask, what purpose does this serve? Is the question always that this capacity developed to do what?
Yes. Yes. when you're trying to explain something in literary terms, that is exactly what you do. In other words, how did we get to this great prefrontal cortex? Or for that matter, how come that our smell area in the nose is, compared to our sister species and our parent species, exceptionally large? In other words, we have the capacity to smell better than they have, and why did it come about, right? That's a desert adaptation. Because under the dry conditions of the air, you need a larger smell surface in order to catch the molecules in such a fashion that they trigger sensation, you see?
Another question that will eventually get me, hopefully, where I want to go. I'm a dog person. My family.
You're a dog person.
I'm a dog person.
Oh,
my family
God.
Is a dog person.
Sleeping right beside me here.
Wonderful. My dog would be interrupting the interview and making all sorts of noises.
That's what I was afraid this one would be, but she's behaving.
Well, I don't have a tennis ball, so I'd have no solution. But anyway, I was watching a documentary on on dogs, and what they suggested. And I wondered what you think about this, especially given your work on mammals. They suggested that dogs and human beings evolved alongside one another and that one couldn't evolve the way that one evolved without the other evolving simultaneously.
That's correct.
So if that's the case,
yes,
then is all evolution a system in that – everything is going to change and evolve intertwined with how the other creatures that evolve and intertwine affect one another? Is it possible to think about evolution as in discrete individuals, or is it much more accurate to think of it as systemic and relational?
No, I think what happens here is two things. No evolution can take place as long as we can solve a problem. If we can solve a problem, we stay the same. Evolution can take place only when we, as a population, are stressed and cannot solve a problem very well. But there are a few individuals that do, and their genotype survives. That's how evolution works. And because we have an enormous capacity to deal with problems, evolution comes to a halt. Now, the evolution of dogs, of course, came out of wolves attaching themselves to very successful hunters in the Upper Paleolithic. When you kill a large surplus of reindeer, you leave a lot bones and guts and everything else behind. And so there came the possibility for wolves to systematically attach themselves to human beings and profit from them. And the ones that survived are dogs.
I just interrupt for a second? I want to hear the rest of the story. But the amazing thing about the evolutionary explanation is once you say it, it makes so much sense. it's just intuitively obvious, right? Not in any way that I could have figured out by myself, but that, of course, right, when human beings, early humans hunted, they left a lot of waste.
Yes.
And it was in the interest of the animals to attach themselves to the creatures that left waste because it was easier to eat. Right?
Absolutely.
It just makes so much sense.
Yeah. And that's how dog domestication began.
Huh. So please continue. Please continue. I'm just getting excited.
Well, of course, not only that. First of all, the dogs themselves, the wolves, changed into dogs. And they changed quite profoundly, by the way. Dogs and wolves are not the same creatures. Not today. Not anymore. The difference is quite profound. Yeah. But at the same time, we then also exercised a selection because we liked these animals. We were rich enough to give them food. We would pick out the ones that we really, really enjoyed, and they enjoyed our company in turn and so on and so forth, so that we began to draw out lines of animals that began to change in our image. That's why you have the great diversity of dog breeds. They are expressions of human playfulness. And they are, of course, each dog breed is, of course, a piece of art. So that was the beginning of the domestication process. And, well, it has also some repercussion of today, because if you introduce wolves into settled landscapes, what happens is they interbreed with dogs and they change into feral dogs eventually. Hmm. And you lose your wolves.
can species,
yes,
self-select? And what I mean by that is human beings, right? We've managed to breed dogs in various different ways for various different tasks. Can we decide, well, we only want, I don't know, I'm going to try non-controversial examples, right? Only tall people or only blue-eyed people people who have intellectual wisdom, but aren't very dexterous with their hands. How much control would human beings or would any species have, but I guess human beings specifically, over their own selective choices?
Well, if you decide to do eugenics, you can do it. Yes, it can be done. But God thanks, we are fortunately not too tempted to do that. And basically, the evolutionary process stagnates because, to give you an example, slight differences in genetics are actually quite advantageous in a couple, because their children will most likely be healthier and in better condition and so on and so forth. So we have means and ways of avoiding inbreeding and et cetera. But because of this enormous populations that we have now and the freedom to choose and to be with others, there's really no great evolutionary change going to take place. We're going to remain the same. If we were all globally to become Spartans and go through the exercise that Sparta imposed on its males and females, yeah, that would be a change.
You would we have to control the entire human population
yes.
with, you know, with yes, absolute yes. fascist control?
Absolutely,
right?
Exactly. And yeah, it's, and you put it quite correctly. Fascist control could lead to some evolutionary change, but only fascist control.
And yeah. I have one last question, and because it touches on the fascism thing, you have a discussion of art as you use this phrase, controlled mental breakdown.
Yes.
And then you talk about how important psychopaths are to history, and you ask them, why would we follow psychopaths? Because we're talking about fascism, and you mentioned Goering what does this phrase controlled mental breakdown mean? What does it have to do with art, and why does it lead to this question of psychopathy?
Well, to begin with, to be artistic requires mental agility or a very, very, a great agility of the mind and the brain. It so turns out, of course, that those people which have a very high agility in certain parts of the brain are mentally ill. And what comes out of the studies that I've been doing and the relation to desert is the following. It turns out, let's take schizophrenia. It turns out that schizophrenic individuals have, they're bright, particularly when they're young, they're very, very, very bright, very able, but they also have a tremendous capacity to resist pain. And they are very enduring. They can go and go and go for a long time. And they also are lucky because in desert conditions, schizophrenics are less likely to be infected by bacteria. They are schizophrenics are a little bit more likely to be infected by bacteria than most people are in wet countries. So what we have actually is that human beings, which became leaders because of their ability to beguile others, by their ability to solve problems, by their ability to be tough and determined, by their ability to instill in others visions and so on, these individuals were borderline schizophrenics or psychopaths or sociopaths. And that is part of our genetic background. What I'm arguing in the chapter that you have is that what makes us sapiens is the ability to skillfully control these mental activities. In other words, we have encapsulated a touch of insanity within us. And this encapsulation holds very, very well. It's only very few people that break down. It's about 1 in 100, really, that become schizophrenics and so on. Yeah, but we all carry some of that. And this is where some of this horrible statistics comes out, that university professors tend to have a quarter of their children with mental problems, you see. So brightness and ability and so on comes back to this mental agility, which in its extreme form generates mental illness. But we could not have survived without it.
So why are these sociopaths so attractive? Why are they charismatic leaders?
Yes. Well, yes, they are. To begin with, they're charismatic leaders. They are ruthless. They are very charming. They're usually very, very good at social beguiling of others, yeah? And but above all, they are tough. And they are charismatic, and under very hard conditions, they will carry on and will force others to carry on. And all of that, under desert conditions, was at times highly, highly adaptive. That's why we are condemned to art and insanity.
I feel like I could be talking about this for the rest of my career. I know you chose to do that. And what I find just incredibly fascinating is that we really did take the complete human journey from the very beginning to now. And as I said, the explanations, they make so much sense. And that is not something you get to say in philosophy very often. So Val, thank you so much for joining us on Why. This has been just a tremendous conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Valerius Geist on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and I'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Valerius Geist about evolution and asking why Homo sapiens evolved into artists. And this was one of those discussions that we started in one place and we ended up a universe away, or I should say millennia and millennia and millennia away. We asked why Homo sapiens evolved into artists, and we ended up learning about dogs and why dogs were involved in human life. And we ended up talking about plumbing and why my reaction to a plumbing problem represented the whole human experience. And we also redefined what luxury meant. We are in a time now, especially in the United States, when we are preoccupied with wealth. We are preoccupied with the gold-leafed, attention-seeking billionaires who now seem perhaps to control our politics as well. That's not what evolution means by luxury. What evolution means is the ability to not panic, the ability to get outside of survival mode, the ability to say, I can prepare for the future, or I can create something new, or I can think about something for just a minute. What this means is that luxury is not something we don't need. It's not an extra. Evolutionary luxury is an absolute necessity. The ability to think, the ability to be creative, the ability to add novelty into our world, this is the essence of what it means to be a Homo sapien. This is an essence of what it means to be a human being. Luxury is not something that allows us to have five cars. Luxury is the thing that allows us to be fully human and to improve the species and hopefully the world because of our thoughts. Art, then, is a central part of this. We developed art because it was the vehicle to help us imagine. It was the play that allowed us to compare free thought and disciplined thought. It was the ability to create status and have cohesive groups. And it was a way that we talked to the dead. It was a way that we talked to the future. It was a way that we talked to ourselves. Homo sapiens evolved into artists because without evolving, they couldn't do anything other than run. They couldn't do anything other than eat what was in front of them. Homo sapiens evolved into artists because art is absolutely essential to anything that isn't the most immediate panicked mode. And I know we have to be reluctant to find moral lessons from the evolutionary history to today, but I would ask you simply this. Next time someone says art isn't important, next time someone says we shouldn't fund or encourage or celebrate or expose ourselves to art, look at them and say, you are asking us to not be human. You are asking us to not evolve. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.